Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, coalition talks in Germany have collapsed, with the Free Democratic Party withdrawing from negotiations led by Chancellor Angela Merkel. As political uncertainty deepens, will the country have to call another election? Next, Zimbabwe's leader Robert Mugabe is defying pressure from both the military and his own ZANU-PF party to resign. Tomorrow he faces the possibility of impeachment. Then, on the heels of a controversy over a NATO war game where the enemy units were designated as Ataturk and Erdogan, a top advisor to the Turkish president has called into question Turkey's membership in NATO altogether. And finally, the Trump administration has officially designated North Korea to be a state sponsor of terror, ratcheting up tensions days after the head of the U.S. Strategic Command openly discussed the possibility of the military refusing illegal orders to launch a nuclear strike. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first we turn to Germany. Coalition talks in Germany have collapsed with the Free Democratic Party withdrawing from negotiations led by Chancellor Angela Merkel. As political uncertainty deepens, will the country have to call another election? We're joined from Berlin by Rainer Braun, co-president of the International Peace Bureau. Rainer, welcome.
Hello.
So I think the most immediate and important question is, does this herald the end of this very short-lived government? Should we be expecting elections again?
You know, it is not totally clear what will happen in the future. 70 or 80% reality will be that there will be new elections because the possibility for develop a coalition for the new government is quite over. The Social Democrats don't want to go again in the Great Coalition, between the Great Coalition where the Conservatives destroyed the Social Democratic Party, above all because of the undemocratic and unjust politics of this government. The alternative, a coalition so-called in Germany, Jamaica coalition, because of the color of the three parties, Conservative, Greens, and Liberals, is not happened because of the differences between these parties. But in reality, the differences when you are looking to the main points of politics, social justice, peace, ecological development, sustainability, are not great. All of them are against these main figures. It is mainly a controversy between a more modern capitalistic modernization with some individual democratic rights and a very reactionary, unprogressive politics, mainly developed by the conservatives and the liberals. And both sides, the more capitalistic modernization side and the very reactionary side, are equal strong. So there is no hegemony on one side. And that makes it so difficult to find compromises. So it is a fight between the elites for a continuation of an undemocratic, not peaceful politics. That is the reality between this big show they were producing during the last 4 weeks.
Rainer, Germany, and in particular the leadership of Merkel since 2005, has been in many ways the rudder, the anchor for the EU, not just for Germany. So what does this mean, this instability within the German political situation, something unprecedented perhaps for the past seven decades? What will it forecast for Europe?
You know, we should be very cautious to say that the situation is totally or is instable, because the common points of all these parties I mentioned, including the Social Democrats, is related to Europe, to a more militarized Europe, to a neoliberalistic authoritarian Europe. It's quite the same. So it is a more tactical fight.
But that said, Rainer, I understand that the elites have a similarity in their program, their allegiance to militarism, their allegiance to a neoliberal policy. But the fact that they're falling out amongst themselves and the fact that they don't have a dominant force like Merkel's party that's able to dictate the terms. That kind of instability at the top, I don't mean that they have a fundamental difference. That instability at the top has an impact, no?
Yeah, but maybe the leadership goes for a short term on the other side of the River Rhine. We have a quite stable French government, which tries to be a bigger leader in Europe, which comes out with some interesting neoliberalistic, very militarized suggestions for the common future of Europe. And last week, we have an agreement between 23rd of the European countries about a new European militarized union. So I cannot see that there is very, very much instability. And also have in mind, you know, it will be 8 or 10 weeks. Then Germany will have elections. And then there is a chance for developing a new government. So we should be very cautious to speak too quick about instability. For me, the main point is, can we develop an opposition in these unclear situations against these whole undemocratic, unjusted, and militarized politics?
Reiner, many observers here in the United States are saying that the likelihood in the event that there are new elections is that the Christian Democratic Union will, of course, come in first again, but it might not necessarily want Angela Merkel to be its leader. Do you think there's a possibility that this is the end of the Merkel era?
You know, it is definitely the end of the Merkel era because of the last 2 or 3 years, her influence dramatically reduced. This has something to do with the refugees. It has mainly to do with the change of the atmosphere in the country. Many people don't believe that she is leading Germany in a more progressive social future and become a little bit more concerned about their own future. And this is the background of the winning of the right-wing party. And this is also the background that Merkel lost her big image that she has in the country. So it is definitely the beginning of the end of the Merkel era. But, you know, after 12 years, normally the era of a German chancellor comes to the end. Have in mind when Kohl was going down, he left power after 16 years. So he also goes down after 12 years. And I believe the problem of the conservatives is that Merkel was so strong that there is not a second man or a second woman, no one who is really behind her and can take over the power. So there will be a bigger fight in the conservative parties and in both parties, in the conservative parties of the whole country and in the conservative party of Bavaria, which is a little bit independent from the others. There will be a big fight who will be the leaders, and this makes the conservatives even weaker. So I can imagine that for the next elections, the only candidate could be Merkel because the internal fight need sometimes till the fight comes to an end. So my belief is that Merkel will again lead the conservatives to the next elections, but her time is definitely coming to an end.
So we have the conservatives, but then we have the far right, the alternative for Germany. It's emerged as the third strongest political force in the country's national election in September. How does this situation, the situation right now, impact AfD?
You know, they believe they could be the winner of the situation. They believe when there are fights between the elites, they can say, look, the elites could not rule the countries. We are the only alternative. Vote for us. But, you know, they have also many, many internal problems and fights. And there came a lot of scandals to the public during the last months. They lost some of their leading persons, even some of their founding members like Petri. So they have also some problems, and their image is not any longer so clear and so white like it was in the past. So I'm not totally sure if the next elections will be in the same way successful for the right wing than it was in the past. We had in the past the situation that people in the first elections were voting in opposition to their normal vote. But then, after saying sometimes they don't want to continue with this way, they were coming back. So let's see. I'm a little I have some hope that with the public work of the left and the liberal forces, the progressive forces in the public, with the work of the trade unions and the peace movement, the social movement, to show what is the reality of the right wing and the destroyment of the right wing by itself, that we can have a little bit less votes for the right wing by the next elections.
Rainer, I'm wondering what the reaction is going to be to all this elsewhere in Europe. And I'm thinking particularly of Greece. Greece is the recipient of so much German aid as it tries to get back on its economic feet. It has a love-hate relationship with Angela Merkel. It hates the fact that it has to borrow money from Germany, but then respects Merkel because she's the one that pushes this through the German parliament. What do you think these political changes are going to mean for places like Greece or Spain or Portugal even?
You know, I think in reality, all these countries are happy that Germany has to do with itself, had their internal discussions, and could be not develop so many authoritarian forces against the other governments. I think they are very happy that the situation in Germany is a little bit instable, so that they can really develop a little bit their independent own forces and own politics. You know, look at Portugal. Who was doing this during the last 9 or 12 months under these social democratic left-supported governments, and they were very, very successful. And the other countries see what can happen when a government developed a more independent politics, not following the authoritarian and austeritarian rules given by the German government. And I think they are happy when Germany has their crisis. They will be really happy.
Rainer, you talked about the fact that what's important here is not so much what's going on at the top, the instability among the elites. It's whether progressive movements, people's movements, grassroots movements can take advantage of the situation for the reorganization or the reemergence of a left in Germany. Talk about what that would look like and what its prospects actually are. We have about a little bit more than 90 seconds.
You know, it is interesting. We had a National Peace Day on Saturday. It was a quite successful day. Mainly, we are fighting against the nuclear weapons and the 2% of GDP for military spending. So the social movements really know that they have now a chance to bring their positions in the public, to fight for their positions, and the instability gave them also new possibilities to influence the political parties and the elites. So I think they are starting really different campaigns, social campaigns, environmental campaigns, developing campaigns, to develop much more pressure on the government and the political parties. And hopefully they will have some successes after the next elections.
Brian, you know, this seems to be not a repudiation of Merkel's politics as much as it seems to be a repudiation of Merkel. Maybe it's just time for a change in Germany. We've seen statements today, for example, from the Greens and the Free Democrats saying that there was great progress made in these talks, especially on issues related to immigration and climate change. But I think they're just tired of Merkel.
Yeah, she's been there since 2005. That's a long time. Rainer, go ahead. You have the last word. 30 seconds.
You know, she is not any longer the hegemon leader of the political elites. And this makes other forces stronger and make her weaker. And these forces are now fighting against each other. They want to have different imperial interests. And our, as social movements, we have totally the opposite interests. We are using these fights for bringing our social, democratic, peaceful positions much more in the public than before. And I hope that we will be a little bit more successful than we were in the past.
That's the voice of Rainer Braun, co-president of the International Peace Bureau. After a very short break, we'll be back. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
On the heels of a controversy over a NATO war game where the enemy units were designated as Ataturk and Erdogan, a top advisor to the Turkish president has called into question Turkey's membership in NATO altogether. We're joined from Istanbul by Jada Karan, a columnist at Cumhuriyet Daily. And we're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of the Duran. Welcome, Jada and Alexander.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Jada, let me start with you. We read reports in the newspapers about this over the weekend here in the United States, and it seemed so ridiculous that the only way something like this could happen is if either a low-level nobody in NATO just didn't know any better, or someone in NATO set out to embarrass the Turkish government. What do you think happened here? Can you explain to our listeners what happened and why this is so important?
Actually, the timing, I think, is important because actually, I don't know what happened in Norway, but the timing is important here because, because of the domestic politics, because of the Turkish foreign policy, Turkish Islamist government almost lost all of its cards in Syrian war. And Turkey, together with the Russians and Iranians, changed its course regarding Syrian policy, Middle East policy. And, a Turkish government tries to get a Russian S-400 anti-aircraft system. They have huge problem with the U.S. government on a number of topics, including the Reza Zarrab case, which is an important piece. But if you look at a Turkish domestic policy, also you see that under Erdogan, Turkey transformed since the last year's July's failed coup. Erdogan is a strong leader. He among the Muslim Ummah, global Muslim community, and Turkish Muslims. But also, he demonized the rest of the population inside Turkey, the seculars, liberals, social democrats, leftists, Kurds. And he's now in a very difficult situation. He is support of modern Turkey. And he recently tried to portray himself as a supporter of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of our modern republic. And he's trying to change his, tone. And he's openly, for some times, he's against European Union policies. He's against policies of the United States regarding Middle East issues. But the most important thing for Erdogan is the elections in 2019. And his party, AKP, had never received more than 50% of the vote, and he needs nationalist votes. He needs votes other than his grassroots, So the timing is, I think, is important here because this became a card for Erdogan because now he claims that NATO is against Turkey, the Westerners is against Turkey. And we have huge problems with the Western world.
Let's bring Alexander in. Alexander Mercouris, it's true. I mean, Erdogan has been a chameleon, and he's been in a hot spot over and over again. He was in a hot spot with his relations over Syria, and his hot spot with the relations with Russia, and a hot spot with his relations with the EU. And at each time, he's been able to sort of maneuver and shift and mend relations after they had already soured. But what do you think about our other guest's sort of assessment that post-July coup, July 2016 coup, that was the game changer for Erdogan? And what do you think in terms of what's going on now? Is it positioning for the 2019 election, playing the nationalist card, or is it something deeper?
I think all of these elements are there. And I think we should also say that the talk at the moment of Turkey leaving NATO is, I think, very premature. Having said which, I think the deterioration in relations between Turkey and the Western powers has been ongoing under President Erdogan for some time. And looking at this from his point of view, it is not difficult to see why. He must feel at some level that the Western powers led him up the garden path in Syria. He was encouraged to intervene there, to open his borders, to help all the various rebel groups in Syria. What happened was that the rebel groups were defeated. Turkey now has a huge Kurdish problem in Syria on its hands. It sees the U.S. Congress openly supporting the Kurds in Iraq and sending money to them. It sees military advisers from the United States in Syria amongst the Kurds. It sees Turkey's concerns about the Kurds simply ignored. He also saw, I think very much to his dismay, that during the coup last year, there was very little real support from him, very little strong support from him, from Western governments. And over and on top of all of that, there is constant criticism of him. There are suggestions that Turkey, whilst it is led by him, can never become a member of the European Union. And Turkey, which is, let us be very clear, a very big country indeed, one of the most powerful countries in NATO. It's got the second biggest army in NATO. It is a key country in the Middle East. It's simply not being listened to. It has its concerns in the Middle East. It's not part, but they're not really regarded anymore. It has its concerns in Europe. They're not paid much attention to either. And one can sense a growing frustration, not just on the part, I suspect, of President Erdogan himself, but on the part of, I suspect, quite a lot of people in Turkey, at the way in which Turkey is being taken for granted, its leaders, President Erdogan himself, Kemal Ataturk, are being held up for ridicule in NATO exercises. No real apology is given. No real attempt to correct that is made. And, of course, the result is a steady deterioration of relations.
Jada, let's go back to you. You're making the point that in order to win, Erdogan needs to go beyond his base. In other words, the kind of more conservative, perhaps less urban, more Muslim parts of society. He needs to do that, and as you're suggesting, perhaps playing the nationalist card against the West in order to broaden his support. But help our audience, especially the audience here in the United States, where this show will be played today, how do the Turkish people feel about Erdogan? And does that sort of a resentment towards the West or towards the perceived bullying by the West, the insults, the slights from the West, is it resonating with a broader part of the Turkish population that wasn't traditionally pro-Erdogan?
Yeah, but it's a general thing, you know, because it's general mood in Turkey. It's including, it's not just the Islamists. Actually, the Islamists, of course, when they're talking about the Muslim cause, Palestinian-Israeli issues, blah, blah, but they are all against Western policies. But other than this, for years, since the Turkey's membership of NATO, the Westerners supported Islamist and rightist governments in Turkey. The Westerners, especially the American governments, always supported the Islamists. And in fact, Erdogan, 15 years ago, his first trip was to the United States. So he rose up with the help of the Western world. We all know that. But in Turkey, all the system based upon the West, including the military establishment, Turkish people traditionally they don't like Western policies, but it doesn't change anything in government policies. So actually, I find a little premature and little weird this quitting of membership of NATO. If you look at the announcement right after this crisis, you see the difference. For example, one of the advisors of president suggested that it is time to question membership. the presence of a great Turkish nation in this NATO has become questionable, he said. But if you check out our Minister of EU Affairs, he also said that we are founding members of NATO, which is not true, by the way, and we are important force in NATO. It's unimaginable to think NATO without Turkey, he said. And also, if you check out the chief of general staff, Hulusi Akar, which he participates in International Security Forum held in Halifax, Canada today. If you check out his words, he said NATO had been the most successful and effective military organization in his. And he said, we should not allow anyone to undermine our alliances, solidarity, he said. It's the difference between, I'm trying to explain you, the difference between the general mood in Turkey and the executive branch, the government level. It was always like this. And so it's nothing. I mean, Turkish people always criticize Western policies. That's nothing.
Sure. Well, let me ask Alexander Makouras then. With that in mind, Alexander, you know, these are all very important points. Turkey is the second largest, as we've all said, the second largest military in the alliance. It's an important economic power. It's NATO's anchor in the Middle East. Is there a scenario where Turkey is not a member of NATO, a realistic scenario anyway?
Asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have said no. I would. I mean, NATO has very deep roots in Turkey. Indeed, the Turkish military have generally been extremely committed to NATO, and the entire Turkish political system has, up till very recently, been structured around NATO. And I agree. I don't think President Erdogan, when he became leader of Turkey many years ago now, had any intention to change that. Certainly not until recently. But when you have a situation when Turkey's interests are completely disregarded and Turkey's opinions are held to no account, and when the president of the country is basically treated in a most offensive way, and this goes on week after week and month after month, so President Erdogan goes to the United States, for example, he meets President Trump, he finds President Trump completely uninterested in him and completely unresponsive to his concerns about Kurdistan. When this happens, and it happens repeatedly, there comes a point when people start to ask questions and start to make the sort of comments, the kind of public comments that they have made. Now, it is a very different thing when you hear criticism of NATO from left-wing people in Turkey, of whom, incidentally, there are many. Turkey has had a very large traditional left, which has had a very difficult history behind it. When somebody who is from a conservative Islamist background and who is an advisor of President Erdogan starts talking in that way, it is beginning to be different. I don't think Turkey is going to quit NATO anytime soon. But I do think that in order to ensure that that doesn't happen, Western powers, the United States especially, need to start taking Turkey more seriously. If they don't, well, it may change.
I'm sorry that we have to leave that as the final thought. Thank you very much for joining us. We were joined by Ceyda Karan, a columnist at Cumhuriyet Daily in Istanbul, and Alexander Makouras, the editor of The Duran in London. Thank you so much for joining us. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear, and we will be right back after a very short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The Trump administration has officially designated North Korea to be a state sponsor of terror, once again, ratcheting up tensions days after the head of the U.S. Strategic Command openly discussed the possibility of the military refusing illegal orders to launch a nuclear strike. We are joined from Kalamazoo, Michigan by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. Welcome back, Kevin Camps.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is kind of remarkable. And there's both Senate testimony, the testimony by U.S. senior U.S. military personnel in charge of the nuclear command before military conferences, saying more or less, hey, if we get an illegal order, we have an absolute obligation, a legal obligation to refuse carrying out an illegal order. And if there was an illegal order to, say, start a nuclear war, which is what people are worried about, the military would take action to stop it. That's one thing. And then we have the new move by the Trump administration designating the DPRK again as a state sponsor of terror. George W. Bush's administration in the second term took North Korea off that list. Well, anyway, go ahead. Talk about both of these developments.
Sure. I mean, the assurance from the commander of Strategic Air Command that he simply would not obey illegal orders sounds nice. Maybe he's trying to calm people down that the military has some smarts to it, has some control. But you got to remember that when the president of the United States orders a nuclear weapons launch, that this all goes down within minutes. Actions are taken within minutes. So I do hope that that commander has thought this through very carefully, because I'm not sure it's as simple as he put it forth. I mean, that's the reason that so many groups are calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons, because no single man should have that much power, or woman. It would take tremendous courage and risk, I would say, by senior military leaders to disobey that order. I hope that they have that courage to do so when the time might come. I hope it never comes.
CNN, Kevin, has been reporting on some real anxiety on Capitol Hill. There was a statement earlier today by Senator Chris Murphy, who's a Democrat from Connecticut. He said, "We're concerned that the president of the United States is so unstable, so volatile, has a decision-making process that is so quixotic that he might order a nuclear weapon strike that is wildly out of step with U.S. national security interests." That's kind of interesting. What was more interesting to me, though, is that Republicans, at least Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, while they may not have made statements as blunt as Murphy's, said, well, you know, we really ought to have hearings on this thing because we don't really trust Donald Trump with nuclear weapons either. Do you see this as something new, or is this just politics?
Well, the hearing itself was pretty remarkable. As Senator Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, pointed out, there had been no such hearing on the authority of the president of the United States to start a nuclear war, to launch nuclear weapons in 41 years on either side of Congress. So this is very much a Trump-inspired anxiety. And, you know, who really deserves credit is Senator Markey, who took part in that committee hearing. He's on that committee. He and Ted Lieu in the House have introduced legislation to prohibit a first strike by the United States without congressional authorization. So that bill is still pending and really deserves support.
And, you know, it was Ed Markey as a congressman back in the early 1980s who was the leading proponent of a nuclear freeze with the Soviet Union. Markey is no newbie to this issue. He's been fighting against nuclear weapons for his entire adult life.
Yeah, ever since 1976, when he, at a very young age, entered the U.S. House. And I was present when he was awarded an Alliance for Nuclear Accountability Achievement Award, essentially, for his work on Capitol Hill. We're a member group of the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability. And he told the story as to why he's so interested in these issues. When he was a sophomore in high school, he was assigned a science project, had no idea what to do. His dad ran a dairy in the Boston area. And his dad took him, this is back in the 50s or 60s, took him to the dairy to show him all this equipment used for testing strontium in milk because of the nuclear weapons testing fallout that was going on in the Northern Hemisphere, in Nevada, in the Pacific Ocean, in the former Soviet Union. And that began Ed Markey's concern about nuclear weapons back when he was in 10th grade.
You know, let's talk about the protocol for how nuclear weapons get used? Because here we have the military leadership saying, well, you know, if the illegal order comes down and we judge it to be illegal, we'll come back to the president and give him legal options. In other words, they were sort of saying, we'll talk him through it. Now, it's not just about first strike launches, though. There can also be a protocol for a response based on what appears to be a nuclear attack from an enemy force. In other words, this also happens. There are protocols, and we're talking about minutes. We're not talking about hours and certainly not days. We're talking about minutes. You know, Kevin Camps, in September 18th, the Stanislav Petrov died. He was a Soviet commander who, at the age of 44 in 1983, was in charge of monitoring the Soviet nuclear program. And they had coming across the screen 5 Minuteman missiles from the United States. And the protocol demanded that he launch, because the U.S. nuclear weapons were about to strike the Soviet Union. This was in 1983. And he made a personal decision based on gut instinct, as he said, not to carry out that which was necessary based on Soviet military protocol, which was to launch. And as a consequence, and as we found out later, those nuclear missile launches, the 5 Minuteman missiles, were in fact not there. It was a blip. It was a glitch.
Phantom launch.
A phantom launch. If he had done what he was supposed to do, we would have had thermonuclear war, because then the U.S. would have counter-launched. In other words, that's how close all of this is. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was the sun rising and the sunbeams hitting clouds, and the Soviet early detection radar mistook it for launches. And that's the kind of courage that Petrov demonstrated, the man who saved the world single-handedly, that would be required of U.S. military commanders defying orders from President Trump if he's in a rant, as is so often apparent when he tweets very provocative things on his Twitter account. You know, there's another story like that from the Cuban Missile Crisis, where a Soviet submarine commander was the no vote on firing nuclear-tipped torpedoes at U.S. warships who were dropping depth charges on the sub, had knocked the air out on the sub. The Soviet sailors were passing out for lack of oxygen. For all they knew, they were going to die. And it took a unanimous vote of the top 3 officers on the sub to launch their nuclear weapons, which the U.S. did not even know that they had, and he voted no. And that could have precipitated a full-on nuclear war, you know, in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So we've dodged nuclear war a number of times since it happened in 1945, but how many bullets we can dodge, we've got to abolish these things.
And ours is a government that will not make a no first strike policy. And ours is a government led by a man who has repeatedly asked his generals, if we have nuclear weapons, tell me again why we don't use them.
And actually, you know, U.S. policy, even under Obama, who made that famous speech in Prague in early months of his administration, 2009, about abolishing nuclear weapons, but then he unfortunately said, not in my lifetime will it happen. You know, there's this $1 trillion nuclear weapons renovation plan over the next 30 years, including usable nuclear weapons, for lack of a better word, mini nukes, nukes that could be used as bunker busters to take out hardened facilities, as in North Korea or in Iran. And, you know, George W. Bush was toying with that kind of idea. And under the Obama administration, too, these moves to create a nuclear cruise missile indistinguishable from a conventional cruise missile. So the receiving party would have to decide in real time, on very short notice, if their response to this cruise missile attack is going to be nuclear or conventional, not knowing what's coming in until it goes off. So those are the kind of, you know, games that the United States is playing with its nuclear weapons policy that could really blow up in our face. You know, we're playing with fire.
Talking about games, the United States routinely carries out war games. They're not really games, and they're certainly not funny. Certainly not funny if you live in North Korea, that simulate the destruction of North Korea. The recent games also included overflights right by North Korea of B-1B bombers sent all the way from, I think, Omaha, Nebraska. Again, weapons powerful enough to really cause the mass damage, weapons of mass destruction, really. But here we have, Kevin Camps, the Trump administration now announcing that they're putting, the U.S. will put North Korea back on the terrorist nations list. Again, this comes right after Trump made this amazingly belligerent, bellicose speech before the South Korean parliament, where he devoted almost the entire speech to the complete demonization of North Korea. In other words, a war talk, a talk for war. Where is it all heading? I mean, when you have rhetoric like this ramped up to the max and you have a president saying we're going to totally destroy, or we can totally destroy North Korea, we'll bring fire and fury, we're sending the armada, we're going to put you on a terrorism list. I mean, the North Koreans can only understand this to be an absolute commitment to the destruction of their regime, which would make them not want to get rid of nuclear weapons, but get more nuclear weapons. I mean, are we heading sort of inevitably as a consequence of these sort of policies towards confrontation with North Korea?
There's so much ratcheting up going on, so much escalation. And a part of it, I guess you could surmise, is that the North Koreans really are on the brink of usable nuclear weapons. They've made major advances in their ballistic missile testing program. One of the last hurdles for them is the miniaturization of the nuclear warhead to fit on the nose of a missile and hardening it sufficiently for reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. So they've got a couple more steps. They're years ahead of what even American intelligence agencies thought it would take. So, you know, everything's ratcheting up, and it's very dangerous. It's quite a tinderbox. You know, and the casualty figures, if war does break out, even short of a nuclear exchange, are just off the charts bad, because Seoul is so close to North Korean artillery. So, you know, those who are lovers of peace and lovers of life should really do everything possible to prevent the start of a conflict. And because it's a tinderbox, anything could set it off, just like the story from the Cuban Missile Crisis. Thank God somebody had the courage to not fire that missile, because the U.S. was acting beyond provocatively. The U.S. Warship thought it was having a good time. They were just messing with this Soviet sub they had cornered. Well, they did a little bit too much damage to the air supply, and nobody on board that ship, and for decades later, even knew how close that had come to provoking a nuclear war. And that's the kind of risk we're running right now on the Korean Peninsula, with three U.S. aircraft carriers for the first time in a decade, one of which is radioactively contaminated, the USS Ronald Reagan, still contaminated internally, including the drinking water supply from the Fukushima nuclear disaster.
That's an amazing story. That's the voice of Kevin Camps. We've been talking to him from Michigan. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear us every day in Washington, D.C. between 4 and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday at 105.5 FM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.
Good afternoon. Thank you guys for being patient with us. I brought a special guest, so I figured you might be okay if we were a little bit delayed today. As you all know, the president hosted a very productive cabinet meeting this morning and made some news by announcing that the United States has again designated North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism. As the president said, one of the primary goals of his recent Asia trip was to pursue the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This designation will impose increased sanctions and penalties on North Korea that will continue our progress toward that goal. Additionally, is it a reminder that North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. The president's position is this: the North Korean regime must be lawful. It must end its unlawful nuclear and ballistic missile development and cease all support for international terrorism. This afternoon, we have Secretary of State Rex Tillerson with us to answer some of your questions on this topic. He's going to come up and make a couple of remarks and then take questions on that topic. And as always, I will be back after that to answer other news of the day. With that, Mr. Secretary.
Thanks, Sarah. And as Sarah indicated, the President did make the designation earlier today, announced it in the cabinet meeting. And I think it's really just the latest step in a series of, as you can see, ongoing steps to increase the pressure. I call it the peaceful pressure campaign. The president calls it the maximum pressure campaign. So there's no confusion. They're one and the same. And I think this is, though, to hold North Korea accountable for a number of actions that they've taken over the last several months, the last year or so. Some of you will know that North Korea was designated as a state sponsor of terrorism back in 1988. So they have been designated before. That designation was lifted in 2008 as part of an effort to negotiate with North Korea an end to their nuclear program. That obviously failed, because we can see where we are today. But as a result of actions they've taken, including assassinations outside of their country, using banned chemical weapons, these are all very, very serious actions on their part that put the public at risk as well. So that, along with a number of other actions that they've taken, resulted in their designation now again as a state sponsor of terrorism. I think, as Sarah indicated, the practical effect of it is we already have many of these actions in place through the current sanctions. It may, though, disrupt and dissuade some third parties from undertaking certain activities with North Korea, as it does impose a prohibition on a number of other activities that might not be covered by existing sanctions. But I think, importantly, this is just continuing to point out North Korea's illicit, unlawful behaviors internationally. And we felt it necessary to reimpose the designation for that reason. So with that, happy to take questions. And I'm going to let Sarah referee, because I'm no good at refereeing.
Yeah. So good at it. Thank you,
sir. Mark from CBS. Is this move an intent to incentivize Kim Jong-un towards negotiations? I think it's been more than 60 days since we've seen some kind of test. Do you think that that timetable is in any way promising? And why wait until we are back in the U.S.? The president said that there was hope for diplomacy when we were in Asia, and this seems to be counter that.
No, we still hope for diplomacy. And this is the timing of this is just one of us concluding the process. There is a very specific designation process that we have to go through at the State Department to be able to meet the criteria to make such a designation, and we wanted to ensure we had fully met all those requirements. Again, this is all part of just continuing to turn this pressure up, and we continue to turn the pressure up on North Korea by getting other countries to join and take actions on their own. We've had other countries in our visit to Vietnam, they have committed that they're going to curtail activities further with North Korea. Malaysia has indicated a curtailment. Singapore has cut off all trade with North Korea. The Philippines have cut off all trade. And just recently, the Deputy Secretary of State's been in Africa. He had meetings with the Sudanese government. The Sudanese government have traditionally been buying military weapons from North Korea. They now have agreed to halt all those purchases as well. So this is it's taking effect all around the world. And we think as it takes effect, again, this just continues to tighten the pressure on the Kim regime, all with an intention to have him understand this is only going to get worse until you're ready to come and talk.
Specific to the 60-day window, he hasn't tested in some time. You don't think it's a trigger?
We're hopeful that he continues this quiet period. That's our objective, is that he continue to be quiet as well. This designation, as I said, is one that we're required to undertake from time to time, and we've been monitoring the situation. We wanted to be sure we had sufficient evidence before making the designation. So this is a process that started actually several months ago.
Thanks, Secretary. You mentioned that you're attempting to increase regional pressure against the North Korean regime. Do you have any indication that that is working? And if you haven't seen those indications just yet, how long do you go down this path before the administration has to begin changing strategies?
Well, we get a lot of anecdotal information that it is working, and then we do have our own intelligence sources as well, and then what the Chinese and others share with us, that I think the general belief is it is having a significant effect on North Korea. We know that there are current shortages of fuel based upon what we can gather from anecdotally, but also from certain intel sources. We know that that their revenues are down because a number of the revenue streams are being curtailed now. So I think it is having an effect. Is this the reason we haven't had a provocative act in 60 days? I don't want to suggest to you that I could say, but we're hopeful this period will continue. And again, I think the president in his address in Seoul, South Korea, to the General Assembly. I thought he laid out the case very well to them, that he wanted them to come have talks because he wants to deliver a different future to the people of North Korea.
Olivia.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I have a couple for you. The first is, well, can you give us an example of a third-party transaction that is now covered, that was not covered by either existing American sanctions or the UN Security Council sanctions?
Well, there could be certain dual-use equipment that may not have been covered under previous sanctions that this would prohibit now a third party selling that dual use. And so, and again, I don't want to suggest to you that the designation is suddenly going to put a whole new layer of sanctions on them, because again, I think we already have North Korea so heavily sanctioned in so many ways with the UN resolutions that have been undertaken. But this will close a few additional loopholes off.
You and the President have both referred to assassinations, plural. We obviously all know about the Kim Jong-nam assassination at the airport. Can you give us another example of another assassination on foreign soil?
I don't have anything that I can share with you specifically.
Secretary, here. Thanks. There seems to be more unilateral U.S. sanctions against North Korea on the way. The Treasury is going to announce them tomorrow. Have you given up on getting China to agree to an oil embargo?
We've not given up, and let me say this with China. We continue to talk with them, first to ensure that they are fully committed to implementing all the UN sanctions, and they have assured us they are, which, as you'll recall, the last round of sanctions imposed a pretty severe restriction on the import of finished products, so fuels, petroleum, diesel, jet fuel, and whatnot. But we have suggested to them, look, you control that oil pipeline that feeds their refinery. You can do that unilaterally on your own if you want to increase that pressure. Whether they're doing that or not, we don't know, and it's very difficult for us to know whether they're taking actions to curtail oil supplies to them.
Secretary, earlier today, President Trump said that the Treasury Department is going to be announcing additional sanctions tomorrow. He described it as a very large one, the highest level of sanctions. Can you give us any insight into what those additional sanctions may be?
Well, I'd like to leave it to Treasury to announce those tomorrow. They're similar to sanctions we've taken in the past. We're just going out much more broadly now to more entities. But I'd like to leave it to their announcement tomorrow, not jump the gun on them.
And do you all see today's announcement as more symbolic or as something that really does have a lot of teeth to it?
Well, I think it is very symbolic on the one hand, because it just points out again what a rogue regime this is and how brutal this regime is and how little they care for the value of human life. So I think in and of itself, makes a strong statement of just the nature of this regime. And as I've said, the practical effects may be limited, but we're closing off a few loopholes with this.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mara Liasson from NPR. If China does not agree to cut off oil shipments to North Korea, how can you possibly get enough pressure on them to come?
Well, their fuel supplies are already quite constrained. And as I said, we have evidence that there are fuel shortages in North Korea. Obviously, the civilians are by and large the ones that can't get fuel. So we see long lines of vehicles at petrol stations. We see certain petrol stations that appear to be out of fuel because they're closed when normally they'd be open. So there are indications that fuel supplies are already quite tight. As you know, they only refined a small amount of their fuel needs internally. They only have one refinery that operates, and it operates at a low capacity. So they were heavily dependent on imports of finished fuel products, which have been constrained significantly with the UN sanctions.
But is the Chinese action essential? In other words, do you need China to cut off those oil shipments?
I don't know that the cutting off of oil is the magic wand or the silver bullet that is going to bring them to the table. What I would say is that the North Koreans have demonstrated in the past they have an enormous capacity to withstand a lot. They'll make their people pay. But they have an enormous capacity to withstand a lot. So I don't want to suggest that we think that one action is all it would take to get them to the table.
Margaret Talliff with Bloomberg. Thanks for you. Welcome. Now briefing room anytime. I want to pick up on Olivia's question about the assassinations. How determinative was that in the specific evidence that you used to make this determination. And I also want to ask you, I think you and Ambassador Haley both spent some time with the president, and that's unusual. I know she was in town today. Can you tell us a little bit about that meeting and any substance that came up with?
Well, the assassination in Malaysia was a significant event that caused us to really begin to look carefully at what else they might have been doing. As you know, that assassination involved the use of a chemical agent, a very dangerous agent, in a public place. And so that really got our attention. One of the things that we wanted to ensure is that we had a sufficient certainty around their role in that particular assassination. And so we've been working with Malaysian authorities as well and been in conversation with them. Wanted to let them have their own process obviously play out as well. With respect to Ambassador Haley and I, we were just both in the cabinet meeting today.
Was the threats, I know without getting too much into it, that there had been a suggestion from the North Korean media about some violence directed toward the U.S. president. Was that a determinative factor at all in the decision to make a designation?
No.
Thank you.